From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. The first documented arrival of Africans in English-occupied North America occurred in 1619, while the first Jewish settlers in North America arrived in 1654 in New Amsterdam, now called New York City. These two communities have a long, sometimes complicated, sometimes complementary relationship. As explored in Henry Louis Gates' recent documentary on PBS, Black and Jewish America in Interwoven History.
When I was growing up, I only thought of race in terms of black and white. It wasn't until much later, when I learned about anti-Semitism and the Holocaust, that I realized how endlessly flexible the idea of difference can be. Across history, Jews have been mocked and feared, blamed and banished, envied and imitated, and so have black people. We share that experience. And we share something else as well, a duty to keep fighting hatred wherever it shows up.
Blacks and Jews were able to come together for what, in retrospect, was a pretty brief period and create enormous change in the country.
Why did the NAACP support the creation of the State of Israel? Why did Jews support the civil rights movement? Black and Jewish people recognize only when everyone is safe are we safe.
There is a history that we need to regard and respect. We would not have got certain things done without those alliances.
But I don't want to be accused of romanticizing the golden age of racial relationship between Jews and blacks. It wasn't an untroubled relationship.
That was part of Henry Louis Gates' recent PBS four-part documentary, Black and Jewish America, An Interwoven History. Here in central Illinois, perspective of people who are black and Jewish, or both, we'll talk about a new anthology, Black, Jewish, and Beautiful, Contemporary Bluish Voices. It will be discussed March 9th at Alice Campbell Hall. Joining me are two contributors to this anthology. In studio is Brett Ashley Kaplan, director of the Initiative in Holocaust, Genocide, Memory Studies, and professor of Comparative and World Literature at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And joining us on Zoom is Anthony Russell, a multidisciplinary artist who performs in Yiddish, a language used by Jewish people, with words from Hebrew and other languages. Thank you both for joining us.
Hello. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start both with your origin stories. Brett, where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York City, and my mother is not Jewish. My father comes from a long line of Jewish family. His grandfather, my great-grandfather, was a rabbi. So I grew up on the Upper West Side, which is a very Jewish part of a very Jewish city.
And we know there are Reform, Orthodox, and Conservative Jewish communities. What is the difference, and where does your family fit in there?
My great-grandfather was Orthodox. My grandfather was part of the Reform tradition, and so that's the faith that we grew up in. So when I was a kid, we were part of the Stephen Wise Synagogue, and that's where I had my bat mitzvah. And it was very exciting at the time because I was born in 1968. And so when I was 13, that we had the first woman Reform rabbi, which was just so thrilling for us because, you know, rabbis have traditionally been men. And so this was a very exciting transformation. And our whole community was very proud of that fact.
And what was your experience with black communities?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I went to the Bronx High School of Science, which was a very diverse high school. A lot of my friends from Bronx Science are still my friends. A lot of them are Jewish. Some are not Jewish. Some of my friends in high school were Latinx, or some were black. Some were, you know, the children of immigrants. People really came from all over the place. And I'm very proud to say that I went to the same high school as Mayor Mamdani, although, of course, he graduated many years after I did.
Anthony, let's switch to you. Where did you grow up, and what were some of your experiences culturally?
I was born in Fort Worth, Texas, but I grew up mostly in the San Francisco Bay Area, specifically in a town called Vallejo, which is about 30 miles north of San Francisco. And I come from Black East Texan backgrounds. My father was in the Navy, so he moved around a lot, but the place where I lived the longest was in Northern California. So that's kind of what I consider to be my cultural orientation, as it were. I come from a Christian background on both sides of my family. On my grandfather's side of the family, there's family lore that they brought the denomination of the Church of Christ to the African American community of Texas. So that's kind of my roots. But from a very young age, I had an interest in Judaism. I had an interest in what I knew as the Old Testament at that particular point in my life. And over the course of my life, that put me on a journey that really ended up with me eventually converting to Judaism and then becoming a Jewish artist, really mobilizing Jewish history and Jewish culture as a medium through my work, and also as a way to explore my own Blackness as well.
What struck your interest in Jewish communities growing up before your conversion?
It's interesting because I think, like, as a child, I had very, very little interaction with Jewish community. I think at that particular point, as a child, Jewish people were kind of an abstraction to me. A lot of my interest came specifically from biblical text, came from a real engagement with the Bible as a text, with the narratives as almost kind of metaphors for aspects or moments in my life. So because I had this strong sort of relationship to Jewish text, when it occurred to me to actually have a direct interaction with Jewishness, with Jewish people, with the Jewish space, it was initially from that space of connection to Jewish text that really allowed me to be able to be in these spaces in a way that made sense.
And Anthony, tell us what's in this book and how were you involved in it?
This book is a collection of contributions from various Black Jews about aspects of their lives, engagements with their experiences of being Black and Jewish. I became involved with this book, I would say, initially as one of its contributors. I had had a performance. And shortly after that performance, Brett interviewed me while kind of my impressions of what that was were still very fresh in my mind. This was a project that I was working on, combining 100 years of African American and Ashkenazi Jewish music at points of historic, textual, and musical convergence. That was the name of the project, Convergence. So, my orientation to this project initially was as a contributor. I do have an essay in there where I talk about all of the various things that sort of went into my development of this as a project.
And just for our audience's understanding when you say Ashkenazi Jewish communities. What does that refer to for people who are not familiar with Jewish communities?
So Ashkenaz was a place in central Germany, and it's actually where Yiddish was founded. And this, so Yiddish is, the content of Yiddish is about 80% German, and then around 15% Hebrew, and then 5% incorporated from other languages around the world. So if you're a Yiddish speaker and you're writing in Poland, for example, you'll have a smattering of Polish words. If you're like Sholem Aleichem and you're writing in Russian, you'll have a smattering of Russian words. Yiddish is written in Hebrew characters. But like I said, the vocabulary is 80% German. The grammar of Yiddish is middle high German, because Ashkenaz, this central place where Yiddish formed, was founded in, it was a vibrant Jewish community in the 10th, 9th, 10th, 11th centuries. And then at some point, and I don't have the exact date, there was an expulsion. You know, Jews were constantly being expelled from one place to the other. And so the Jews of Ashkenaz were expelled from Germany and had to travel east. And as they traveled east, they started living in what came to be called shtetls, these little towns where the vast majority of people spoke Yiddish. They also often spoke Russian or Latvian or Belarusian, all the other languages that were where the shtetls were. The Russian Empire decided to delimit where Jews could live. And so the Russian Empire created this space called the Pale of Settlement. And that is the place into which Jews went. And that's where Yiddish flourished. And there were many, many, many daily newspapers in Yiddish. There were publishing houses in Yiddish. Around 1910, 1915 is when secular Jewish literature really took off. And there was a major explosion of Jewish literature, which with the immigrants who were coming from the Pale of Settlement to New York and other places in America, there were then multiple daily newspapers in Yiddish in New York. And so Yiddish was this huge, flourishing language, newspapers, literature, all kinds of letters, bintel briefs. It was just a huge, huge, huge thing. And then two forces started to diminish Yiddish. On one side, assimilation in America, where kids who would normally have been speaking Yiddish were pressured to speak English so that they would assimilate. They wouldn't seem like greenhorns. They wouldn't seem like they just fell off the boat. And then on the other side, of course, the Holocaust eradicated a huge number of Yiddish speakers.
We've been talking with Brett Ashley Kaplan, director of the Initiative in Holocaust Genocide Memory Studies and professor of comparative and world literature at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and multidisciplinary artist Anthony Russell. Both will talk about a new anthology, Black, Jewish, and Beautiful, Contemporary Bluish Voices. It will be discussed March 9th at Alice Campbell Hall. I assume you had to learn how to speak and sing and perform in Yiddish. How long was that process, or what was the process?
It was both a short and a long process. In a sense, it was a short process because of the training that I had from being a classical performer, a classical vocalist. From day one, has to learn how to perform in various, usually European languages, in such a way that they sound like they have an idiomatic command of that language. You know, Leontine Price sang in Italian and in German and in French, and there was the expectation that when she was performing for Italian audiences, French audiences, or German audiences, that they would be able to understand what she was singing because she had an idiomatic command of the sounds of that language. So I brought that kind of sensibility. At the point at which I started this, which was almost 13 years ago, I could read in Hebrew because I had been going to synagogue for a number of years. but I was not actively reading the Yiddish language in Hebrew letters. Instead, I was working from what many Jews in the United States work from when they engage with Yiddish text, which was transliteration, which is taking those Hebrew letters and turning them into Latin letters so they can be read and pronounced by people who use Latin letters, like people who speak English. My experience as a Black performer of music in Yiddish with my audiences is very intense because when I perform music in Yiddish, I'm performing as myself. I'm performing as a Black, queer, Jewish man. I am performing these texts from the store of history and emotion and experience that I possess as a Black individual, as a Black Jewish individual, as a Black Jewish queer individual. And that's how I perform them, which means that there's a lot of emotionality and expression involved in how I do this. And what's interesting is that my audiences, who are mostly Ashkenazi Jews, they have another side of this equation. They have a familial relationship with this language and with this culture and with some of the lives that I depict through my work. And the interesting thing is that I show up in a lot of these spaces as somebody who is, in a sense, pulling those parts of my audience out of themselves and then giving it back to them. And I did not know that that was going to be the case when I started doing this, but that's kind of what's happened. That's what I've observed often happens. It's often a very emotional relationship. Sometimes when I'm performing, like I'm crying or I'm about to cry because it's so kind of emotionally cathartic for me to be able to use this music and to use aspects of this culture as a way of expressing what my life is like. And it's cathartic for my audiences because it's putting them in touch with parts of themselves. I also had a reason for wanting to be involved in this project, which is that I personally feel that Black Jews are a dynamic presence both within and outside of mainstream Jewish community, and that as such, they deserved an opportunity to be able to articulate themselves, to talk about their lives, to talk about their existence as Black Jews and their experience as Black Jewish people. I think it's been too long that we've had Black Jewish actors within Jewish community, and there hasn't been an opportunity for them to articulate themselves as Black Jews, or their articulations have not been collected in one place.
I think it's really important that people understand that this, as far as we know, is the first anthology that combines the voices of Black Jews who come to this experience of being Black and Jewish through multiple ways. So some of the contributors have a white Jewish mother and a Black, not Jewish father. Some of the contributors converted. Some of the contributors are Ethiopian Jews. We interviewed the rabbi of the Abudaya in Uganda, who's the Abudaya are a very ancient Ugandan Jewish community. So we really tried to allow for all different kinds of voices to be included, including people who grew up in Black families and then discovered via DNA tests that they were in some percentage Jewish. And so then had to sort of recalibrate their orientations to the world after that experience. So we're very proud of the way in which the book represents this kind of diversity of how people came to identify as Black and Jewish.
What is a passage that really sticks out in your mind that maybe surprised you?
That's such a good question. There's so many. I think it surprised me when Rabbi Suzumu, who's the chief rabbi of the Abudaya in Uganda, said that the whole category of Black Jew doesn't really make sense to him because everybody in Uganda is Black. So that really stuck with me. I thought that what Teresa Stovall said about the fact that there, you know, the people who identify as Black and Jewish have a possibility to have an intricate and interesting relationship to the question of Israel-Palestine, because so many people in different Black communities identify very strongly with Palestinian voices, and many Jews also identify strongly with Palestinian voices, but there are, of course, other Jewish communities who identify more strongly with Israeli voices. And her point was very apt, I thought, especially given what's happening now, that people who identify as Black and Jewish might have a sort of split affiliation in that regard, and that it would be important to hear those voices. And I thought that it was really interesting that in episode 4 of the Henry Louis Gates Jr., Black and Jewish in America series, there's a lot of focus on the way in which this is a possible split identity. And I thought that was a really great episode, and we're hoping to show it sometime soon on campus. So I think it's really wonderful.
Yeah, you know what it is.
Black and Jewish, Black and Jewish, Black and Jewish, Black and Jewish.
Yeah, you know what it is.
Black and Jewish, Black and Jewish.
We've been talking with Brett Ashley Kaplan, director of the Initiative in Holocaust, Genocide, Memory Studies, and professor of comparative and world literature at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and multidisciplinary artist Anthony Russell. Both will talk about a new anthology, Black, Jewish, and Beautiful, Contemporary Bluish Voices. It will be discussed March 9th at Alice Campbell Hall.
Black dad, Jewish mom, eating a filter fish while pouring dime. Soon as I hit the shoe, I go so hard. I'm Rosh Hashanah. I'll blow the shofar. Get my hair did. Reading the Torah.
What can people expect if they're hearing this and they'd like to attend?
Oh, wonderful question. Thank you. Well, we have, it's going to be a hybrid event, so that's good to know. So if you're listening from somewhere else on the planet, you can Zoom in. It'll be 5 p.m. on March 9th at Alice Campbell Hall, not to be confused with the other Campbell Hall. So it's the Alumni Center, which is off of Lincoln, right near the intersection of Lincoln and Illinois. And there will be a panel. So Anthony and Sarah and I, as the editors of the volume, will be there in person. Some of the contributors will be there in person, and some of the contributors will be coming online. So you can expect people to talk about their contributions to the volume. We also have somebody who is not a contributor to the volume, but who is working on an amazing photo project which documents the lives of Black Jews and includes images of Anthony and his husband. And it, I think, is going to be very powerful. Her name is Ella Cooper. She's a photographer, and she has very graciously provided the cover image for the book, which is also the image on the poster. So you can expect a conversation about the book and contributors to talk for a few minutes each about their contributions.
Before we go, I wanted to ask about something that I learned with Henry Louis Gates series. I always knew the 1908 riot in Springfield, 80 miles west of here.
What precipitated the riot really had its genesis before. A white engineer had been murdered. His name was Clergy Ballard.
That was in July, and Joe James, the Black man accused of killing Ballard, was in the county jail awaiting trial. In August, things got more tense when another Black man was jailed after a white woman claimed he raped her. A large crowd of whites wanted to take matters into their own hands, and on August 14th, they gathered at the jail. The sheriff, fearful of violence, secretly took the two prisoners to another jail about 60 miles away.
When the people discovered that they had been duped, all hell broke loose.
In 1908, about 2,500 African Americans lived in Springfield, about 5% of the town's population. With the prisoners gone, the mob turned its fury on areas where Blacks lived and worked. Homes were torched, Black-owned businesses ravaged. Many Blacks fled, others fought back, and Scott Burton, an African American barber who stayed behind to protect his home, was lynched.
What was distressing even more
What I didn't know, it was two Jewish people, William Walling and Anna Strunsky, who were appalled by the violence, had written about violence against Jewish people in Europe, and they united with African Americans to create the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. When you hear about that as Jewish Americans, what goes through your minds? And that happened, you know, right here in Illinois, just west of here.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's such a complicated and long history. I've written about the horrific story of Leo Frank, which was not 80 miles from here. It was in Atlanta. He was a factory worker who had come from Brooklyn and was falsely accused of murdering a young girl. And he was convicted and was in jail, and a mob came and took him out of jail and lynched him. Now, I just want to be absolutely clear that, of course, the vast majority of people who were lynched were Black, not Jewish. But the Frank case was one moment that really, unfortunately, sparked the resurgence of the KKK. And so that case shows, as we saw in 2017 in Charlottesville, how anti-Semitism and racism can be so deeply intertwined. And it was, you know, really shocking and awful, and transformed the landscape of Southern Jewry, because many Jews left Atlanta and left the area because they felt that it was not safe for them, because, you know, this man who turned out to be totally innocent, you know, had been murdered in this horrible way. So unfortunately, these things have a long history of being together. And we're seeing that now as the, you know, the rise of white supremacy comes back. It's very often still the case, unfortunately, that Jews and Blacks are put together.
The history that you outlined is not an accident. The Kishinev pogrom in Eastern Europe happened in 1903. It was a horrible event that was covered by the international press of Jews being murdered and raped in the streets. That happening in 1903, and then the Springfield race riot happening in 1908. These things are happening in relationship to each other because they represent parallel systems of societal oppression. So it was not an accident that it was through the desire for solidarity, Jewish people and Black people came together to form the NAACP. This is an example of an interesting and very inspirational history that exists between Black people and Jewish people in the United States. I could have an entire other conversation about Yiddish language engagements with the Tulsa race riots and how those were covered in the Yiddish press, and how in the Yiddish press it was really important to cover acts of racial violence that happened to Black people in the United States, because it was something that Jews cared about deeply and allowed them to really figure out what the stakes were in the United States concerning issues of equality, systemic racism, and justice. So yes, that moment really in miniature represents not only historically what possibility existed between Black people and Jewish people in order to enact the reality of America as a space of equality, but a history that I think potentially is embodied in Black Jewish people, and that allows them potentially to be leaders in the ongoing fight for equality in this country and elsewhere.
We've been talking with Brett Ashley Kaplan, director of the Initiative in Holocaust Genocide Memory Studies and professor of comparative and world literature at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Anthony Russell, a multidisciplinary artist who performs in Yiddish. And both will be here to talk about a new anthology, Black, Jewish, and Beautiful, Contemporary Bluish Voices. And that will happen March 9th at 5 p.m. at Alice Campbell Hall, the Alumni Center, not to be confused with Alice Hall, where Illinois Public Media is based. Again, this is Alice Campbell Hall, the U of I Alumni Center. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
Thank you so much. It's been really a pleasure to get to talk with you, Reginald. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
The March 17th primary is closing in. If you still don't know who you want to choose in your gubernatorial as well as local congressional races, we've got you covered, coming up next. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Keep it here. Dialogue from Illinois Soul continues after this break.